Welcome, everyone. This is another morning in DevConf. And for the first talk today, I'll be talking to you about what we have been doing in BMW for the testing of embedded devices and what parts of that I will try to bring into Debian so that other people that are developing embedded hardware can benefit from whatever we are developing in-house and can try to use the tooling that we have and hopefully contribute to it as well. But first about me, a bit. So I'm Aigars Machinos, and I've been a Debian developer for a long time. And I've been a Python developer for almost as long. And so for the last 12 years, I've only developed in Python. In my previous work history, I worked some time for Nokia doing testing for them, and then was doing some testing for the UView setup box for the BBC. So that was another part of embedded hardware that I was helping to test to bring to market. And after DevConf 15, I joined BMW Car IT, which is like a sister company of the BMW Group, where all the software talent is concentrated and grouped together so that we can bring the best of IT area knowledge to BMW processes. And since then, I've been busy testing the next generation head unit for the BMW. Let me recap a bit from my last year's talk, where I was talking about what kind of computers are in the cars. I can be slightly more specific this time because finally the software that we have been developing is actually in cars that are going into release now, and the interfaces have been shown in public. So when you get into a car right now, a modern car, you will be basically surrounded by screens. You can see some of them here. You can see a screen in the center console with the map. You can see a screen just behind the steering wheel with all kinds of indicators, and maybe even a map if it's the car is new enough. You can see a screen on a heads-up display with another set of indicators. You can see a screen for the climate control in newer cars. You can see even a screen on your lock, on your remote. And behind each of those screens, there's a computer, which is running software. And most of those screens nowadays are strong enough computers behind them that they can just run almost regular kind of Linux with applications running on top of them. But that is just the tip of the iceberg, because there are far more computers inside every car, and there will be plenty more. A modern car can have up to 80 different computers in it. Most of them are really small specialized units, like the ones that are controlling the ABS, or the ones that are responsible for communicating with the mobile network, so like a small modem with a built-in firewall and all kinds of security protections that then gives communications interfaces to the rest of the car. There is a movement in the automotive industry to consolidate these 80 computers into something, into a smaller number. But as soon as you consolidate, you bring up the complexity. And the more complexity you have, the more you need testing to make sure that your complexity doesn't break functionality. Another big impact for especially the car market is the longevity of our releases. For example, if we would start development of new software for a car right now, if we freeze the version of every package that is going into a car right now, optimistically, that software will be actually released to the first cars in approximately 2 years. After that, it will take another probably 4 to 5 years for that new software to be extended to the whole range of BMW cars. After that, it will take another couple of years for that software to be released to all range of MINI cars, which are using basically the same software, and another couple of years for that software to be released to a whole range of Rolls-Royce cars. And after that has been done, you actually need to support that software that has been released for up to 25 years. So, yeah, as soon as we freeze software now, we need to do support at least in the sense of security updates for between 25 and maybe even 35 years. When you're looking at these kind of timescales, you can no longer rely on people developing software now even being around at the end of this support cycle. Some of them, they will go on to other things, other software, probably other companies, maybe even entirely different career paths. So, to do the updates of 20-year-old software successfully, you need to have a lot of testing infrastructure in place, a lot of automated testing infrastructure in place that will continue running and continue providing you information if the functionality in your cars is still working after you've updated some library with the new security patch. This brings me to what we do for testing in the project called MGU, so the Media Graphics Unit. That's the computer that is behind the central console, the navigation screen, where we have the navigation, the multimedia, and configuration of your car, and all that kind of stuff. So, in that software project, we have 194 Git repositories where people work on the software. We have 64 SVN repositories. We use those to do like binary releases. So some parts of the software is so hard to build that we don't usually build it fully from source every time. We actually build a binary release committed to SVN, and then in the whole build process, we check it out from the SVN again. We have 62 meta repositories. That's representative of like domains, like navigation domain, multimedia domain, security domain. They are working in their own silos, and then these 62 meta repositories get integrated into one base repository as submodules, which then represents the whole software release. And it contains around 11,000 packages. That's quite a lot for such a relatively simple device as what we have on the central console in the car. We have an image that is more than a gigabyte. We have 12 gigabytes of extra packages. Mostly that's debugging information and extra information that is required, or extra code and tooling that is required for testing. Four hardware variants and 30 different partitions across these variants. So each of those variations actually needs to be tested. And we do three testing levels. So there's a functional level inside the specific domain. So navigation domain, for example, they have like tens of thousands of unit tests and their domain level tests that they do. And once those pass, that goes into a meta repository and does integration level testing. And once the integration level testing passes, we gather changes from all the meta repositories into one place and do a release level testing. And when that passes, we actually create a new release that development continues on from there on. At each level, the software needs to be built, images for all the variants need to be created, and build acceptance tests for every variant needs to be run and pass on both virtual and real hardware for the changes to be promoted up next. So every day we do this whole process for up to five release candidates for up to two branches. So for example, there are cars that will be going into production this autumn. So there's a branch that is targeting those cars. And then there are cars that will be going into production next spring. And they will have slightly different feature set. So there's a separate branch tracking those changes. So we have to do around 800 system builds every week and 2,400 component builds approximately every week. There are more than 2,400 tests executed on each time a build is completed. So every week, more than 1,300,000 tests are executed. There is a lot of hardware doing that. So hundreds of machines, thousands of cores, terabytes of RAM, hundreds of terabytes of storage being used for all of that. And when all that is completed, we can create a new release. And that's new and shiny. And then the real testing begins. Because when the release is completed, we run it through way longer testing scenarios that can take up to a week to complete. So like a question being, for example, if you power on the car and leave it running for 2 hours, does it go into a low power mode when it's supposed to? Does the target reboot start from new if you leave a car for several days? It's supposed to power down completely, so it doesn't drain the battery. And then when you come back, it's supposed to power up really fast. So we do that kind of testing after the release is complete, and a lot of other kind of tests because after my group is done with the software, it gets shipped to several dozen other groups around the world who then flash the software to real physical cars and go through testing scenarios by driving those cars. So if there is something critically wrong with that software, they would have wasted a lot of time and a lot of money if we passed that software on to them. So to do that kind of stuff, we've developed a bunch of testing tooling in-house. And what I want to do is to get at least the commonly useful parts of that tooling out into the public and get it integrated into Debian so that every developer who does any kind of embedded development tasks can either use that directly or look at that for inspiration for their work. This is how the end product looks like. This is the screens that will be going out now in the new BMW X5 and the 8 series. And yeah, so it's both the central console and the so-called combi, or the instrument cluster that is just behind the steering wheel. They're both using the same applications, the same graphical toolkits to produce their results. Let me step back in history and talk to you about AUTOSAR and Geneve. So some time ago, automotive developers recognized that they've been all building very, very similar boxes that do very, very similar stuff, but every one of them has been reinventing the wheel in terms of how these boxes are built, how they talk to each other, what exactly every box is doing, so how the work is divided between the boxes. So they came together in creating the AUTOSAR consortium, where they started to unify standards on how the devices in cars should be constructed, what should be the overall framework, the overall architecture, how devices should be talking to each other, and how the devices should be developed. There is a lot of paperwork, all kinds of standards, and some of them are even useful. So I'm going to talk to you about one of them. So DLT is Diagnostic Log and Trace. That's the interface defined in AUTOSAR to help development of embedded hardware. It's a way of getting diagnostic, logging, and tracing information out of the hardware. The actual implementation, so the AUTOSAR only does like specification standards. It doesn't do any actual software. The actual software for all of this is being developed by another industry group and association called Geneve. And in this case, Geneve developed a set of tools to working with the DLT. It's focused on what's happening with the device during its development, during its debugging. When the software is released, most of those features usually are turned off. The idea is that the DLT is a daemon that's running on the device that is collecting information from a bunch of sources, including system log, including adapters that would feed all kinds of useful diagnostic information into the daemon. By default, the daemon is supposed to store the information in RAM, not actually write it anywhere on the disk, so that it doesn't disturb the device being tested as much. And then when you connect to the daemon with a DLT client, it will dump all the information that it has to this client. So you can get the log from the very startup of the device as soon as you connect to it. And from there on, you get the incremental logging from what has been happening since then. When you've connected it, you are getting the basically stream of the logs from the device in near real time. There's a bunch of tooling to get the different priority levels. One of the key points of structure of the DLT log is that every provider of information declares their application ID and the context into which they are logging. So there's two small textual IDs, and each of those IDs can have different logging level defined. So you can say, okay, I've connected now to the device. I want the syslog to be only at on, show me only errors from syslog, but this application that I'm running that's specifically made to be dumping a lots of information into the log, I want debug level information from that. So the client that is connecting to the DLT daemon can actually control which messages at which debugging level it will receive. And then you can filter down what you see by the application ID and context ID easily. You can log not only textual data, but also binary data, because the log messages are defined as a set of variables which with types. So you can actually efficiently transfer binary data out of the device. It's timestamped on the device, it's timestamped with uptime, and the DLT receiver timestamps when it received every message. And as this is an automotive thing, it's not about just the devices that can actually run Linux or more complex hardware or software. It's also for smaller devices, so smaller embedded chips that do not run a full operating system can still produce DLT logs, and there exist specific hardware devices intended to be connected to the like car network and receive DLT logs from dozens of devices at the same time and writing it all down onto like an SD card. So you can use such a logger on a drive and collect all the information from all the devices with synchronized timestamps. The logs, if you're transmitting binary information from the device, you can have the binary information in the logs. And that is useful when you want to get core dumps, for example. As that is one of the things that is quite used. So when an application crashes, you get a core dump. And sometimes the device does not really want to store a couple hundred megabytes of a core dump. That would be disruptive. So what the tooling around the DLT does, it takes this core dump and transmits it through the log and erases it from the file system, so it doesn't burden the device anymore. And a client can also inject lines into the log, which is used in testing, for example, to indicate through this log, in a time-synchronized manner, when a test, a particular test case, starts and stops, which is then useful in analysis. We use the DLT logging a lot on our devices, so we can often see the cases where there's thousands of messages going out every second, and a test run can produce gigabytes of logs. Naturally, when you have thousands of messages per second and gigabytes of logs, you're not going to read it as a human being. You need some tooling to help you with that. And thankfully, there's some tooling provided. On a basic level, if you actually want to just read stuff and actually see what's in a log, there is the tool called DLT Viewer that is provided by Genevieve. It's a GUI tool to open the log file, to see what are the messages, to filter the messages by all kinds of criteria, and look into the actual like binary data, for example. If you want to have more automation out of that, that is not going to help you much. So for that, inside BMW, we've written a tool that we call DLTLize. It's a framework for analyzing DLT traces. It's a Python-based tool where you feed a stream of DLT log messages through a bunch of plugins. And each plugin is responsible for extracting whatever useful information it can find in this DLT log. It uses libDLT, which comes from Genevieve, and a Python adapter for this libDLT, which was also written in BMW, to parse the logs in C and have the business logic in Python. So we can have the best of both worlds. I can say right now about the licenses. The Genevieve tooling, both Genevieve tooling and BMW tooling for this is released under Mozilla Public License version 2+, And that's how it's going to be published in Debian as well. So the plugins initially declare what application ID, context ID they're interested in. So that allows efficient filtering. So not every plugin gets fed like tens of millions of messages. They get informed when the device starts up, when it shuts down, when the testing cycle actually ends, so that they can report stuff when it's done. And when we do analysis, the plugins take some information from the logs and produce output files like CSV files that I'll show in an example next. And when we do testing using this tooling, we have a way of the for the plugins to produce test results in a JUnit format, so that you can report pass fail, you can say from a plugin why exactly you failed, that way you can actually write tests on this basis. So that again scales up to the scales that we're working on, so thousands of messages per second. With hundreds of plugins running, and because it's using a separate file to store intermediate data, it doesn't block the logging process. So here is an example. The code is there'll be a second slide with the code. The idea of this plugin is to take information about memory usage. So we are assuming that on a device, there is some kind of tool that periodically logs into the DLT the system memory information, so mem available, mem total, buffers cached, shared, and it's just logging that into the DLT log, like once a second, for example. So the plugin here is. In its initialization, is just opening a CSV file that will be the output for the plugin, and sets all the class variables to their initial values. Then, when device is started, we see in the DLT log that device has been brought up. We save the lifecycle ID. So, by lifecycle, we mean okay. How many times this device has been booted up? So that's the lifecycle within test. Lifecycle zero, the first time it's up. And then call is the main function which gets called every time there's a message that is matching the filter that we have defined before as app ID and context ID. So this receives the actual message saying, oh, there's so much memory. In the system. So we take that, we parse it out, split by values, and just write into the CSV file whatever values we found. So this particular plugin doesn't do any processing or analysis on the actual data. It's just taking the data and dumping it. But you can see how you can do more calculations in this context. And at the end, the report just closes the CSV file, and it does a test. So we've been during this the execution we've been storing minimal memory available. So what's the minimum during the whole test run? The memory available has been, and if that is less than a gigabyte, then we add a failure test case to the result. If it's fine, then it's a success by default. And there is an error message that will show up if you run this kind of thing in a Jenkins, you'll have a result XML file, so it will show up as a test failure. And on the right, you can see the output of this script. So on the top, you can see the basically the CSV file that was produced. You see the uptime. You can see the values for all the memory values, and on the bottom I just took it in OpenOffice Calc and created a graph, so we can see that the memory available stabilizes soon after the boot up. So that's good. We don't have any major memory leaks in that, which is kind of the point of this particular test exercise. On top of that, that was about the DLTLize tooling, about analyzing DLT logs. On top of that, we want to also release a test run environment. So that is a bunch of tooling based on top of Nose for executing tests. The idea is being that you define a class that controls all the aspects of your hardware device. So how do you actually power up your hardware device? What kind of modes does it have? How do you run a command on this hardware device? And then this tooling around it does a full cycle of testing on a device. So it sets up the test environment, starts dumping all the relevant log files. It prepares the target, so it switches it to a flashing state, flashes the software, switches the back to normal running state, verifies that it actually came up, and makes sure that the DLT log is started, and puts into DLT a message saying setup is done, all good, let's start tests. It gathers tests, so we have hundreds of development teams. So we actually need to gather tests to be run on a device from hundreds of folders, which also define what type of test every test is, with the meta information written on top of the test. But sometimes we don't want to fully trust that, because we want to have more control over which test is actually considered in build acceptance criteria. So we have separate file that is under control of the release team that defines, okay, these tests are actually build acceptance tests and these are not. And okay, this test, this particular one test, it has been flaky lately. So we still run it, but we do not consider its failure to be a fatal error for the build acceptance criteria. And all that kind of filtering and additional information is what is happening inside this XDE framework test collection suite that is added on top of Nose. In addition, of course, there's the retrying of fail tests if that is useful in some cases. And XDE also marks inside the DLT log, okay, now we've started this test case, then you can see what's happening with the device during the test case, and here we ended the test case. In case the target has been, well, damaged by the test in some way, if there's a crash, for example, what it does, it makes sure that we have fully received the crash dump from the target, and then we usually restart the target, reboot the target, so that we bring it back to a known good state before we execute the next test. Otherwise, you could have like one test doing a crash and then 20 tests right after it failing because they cannot connect to the target because it's down. And the logic specific to a target, to a device, it's encapsulated into Python classes, and we use the hierarchy of Python classes to define common behavior, related devices, related variants of devices. So we currently are using this in three different projects inside BMW. And during the extension from one project using this to three projects using this, we have now defined a common core of the XDE that is useful to all of them, and we're still in process of reviewing what exactly from that is useful for people outside BMW. So it's not fully ready for open source release yet. I was hoping it will be ready by this talk, but it took longer than expected. And when that is done, then that will also be released as open source and packaged for Debian for other people to use. There are other things in this framework that define how it's working. So this objects that are not that are like a global level, a singleton object. So the target is one of those. So you can have an object and code inside of it that encapsulates all the communication with the target, encapsulates all the information about the target, such as which exactly mode it has been booted on last, like take a screenshot. So you can have a function on that level to have to do that. And there is a DLT monitor thing that it's a class that is running in a separate thread that is looking through all the DLT messages coming from the target and manipulating state machines on the test host side to indicate to tests in what state the target is. So is it everything is fine, all the systems are running, all the services have been started, or we are actually recovering from the crash right now. And every test can do things like, okay, we've started monitoring of the DLT log, then we do some kind of action, and instead of trying to figure out if the reaction of the target is good from like screenshots, we can actually make the software on the target log into DLT information about its current state, and then we can in the test see if that state has been reached from the DLT log. So that makes the automation of the testing much easier. And in parallel to test execution, what XD also does is it runs the DLT lies on the DLT file so that you get the live analysis of whatever logs you get from the target. So as soon as the execution is over, you already have the results from that as well. Here is an example target setup that we have. So we have a target device and a test host. The idea is that target device is fully isolated from the rest of the world. It only communicates with the test host through Ethernet, CAN, serial, whatever else is there. And then the test host decides if he wants to forward whatever requests the device does. So in that way, you can, if your device, for example, connects to a service to get information about updates, you can intercept that from tests and provide fake update information to test that kind of functionality. And for power control, we use Arduino with very simple software inside of it, a power relay, so we can just switch off power of the device. We also use that particular setup with the Arduino and a relay to trigger buttons on devices, to connect and disconnect USB devices. So we just have a USB plug, which has a couple of things soldered onto it. So if we bridge them, then the USB device is live, and we disconnect them, it's offline, it's disconnected. So that way we can control these things from software. And then this whole structure runs, and it produces you a set of reports of what is the state of the target right now. What I wanted to do with this is to get as much interesting value from inside the Debian, inside the BMW, into Debian, into the wider open source community. Like in every company, there's naturally a bunch of code, a bunch of software that is like really specific to what we do, and some of it that people are not even proud of being written, but it had to be written. But then there are things that are useful, and that will also be useful to others. I think this is one of them, and I think there are more of them hidden inside BMW, hidden inside other companies. And so I've gotten the permissions to release this software with the idea that maybe other companies, other people will be using this, and if it's good and useful, maybe they'll also start contributing back some changes to it. And if that particular avenue is successful, then it will be far easier for me to convince management to release other parts of tooling that might be useful to others. Therefore, my request to you is to look at this and to figure out maybe it's something that could be useful for you, maybe not only in embedded devices. You could try seeing if this could be useful to test like cloud server instances or other types of systems, and see how that goes. As I do not have a full running setup right now to show you as a hardware setup, I will be writing a set of blog posts later on, also aggregated on Planet Debian, to show exactly how to create an example a test setup using something like a Raspberry Pi as a target device. That will be the thing that will show you more step by step how to use this thing. Eventually, my goal is to have this fully packaged in Debian, so that you could just take a Debian system, install a couple of packages, and have an environment to be able to test your hardware. So that is it. And any questions? There are microphones in front of there.
Hi.
Yep, just keep running.
Hi, thanks for your talk. I'm curious to hear about you maintain the packages and you freeze the packages and then try to release the packages, right? Mm-hmm. If there's something like a security issue, and mm-hmm. then you have to update your package. Yeah. So how do you define your testing coverage to make sure it is not too big or too small? Mm. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's a big and philosophical problem. So when you do, especially it's like security release, how much do you test, and what's happening with the packages there? Basically, when we do a release of software, it goes through all the testing that we have, and both automated and manual testing in actual testing cars. So that does mean that releasing something as a security release would take a while. If there is a critical problem, there are ways to disable functionality in cars really fast. So there's coding on the cars that determines what functions are enabled and disabled. And that can be rolled out really fast to disable a function. And then later on, maybe in a couple of weeks, you can release an update that makes that function fixed and then re-enables it. So there are ways to do that, but it also depends on the security, on the software update functionality actually working fine, which has not been the case before in the cars. Has not been real focus for the cars.
Thank you.
More questions? No? I'll then show you something. So here is it's this way. Here's a DLT viewer. It's currently connected to my laptop. So my laptop is, well, it's Ubuntu, but yeah, kind of Debianish. But the idea is that we have a DLT daemon running on this laptop that gets some information from it with the default tools that are included, and is logging a bunch of information into the DLT log. We have NSYS journal. We actually have information about from system log, from systemd. And so every message that gets logged there will also be transmitted to the DLT log. That's a separate plugin with a bunch of configuration to it. So what information you're putting into there, under what app ID, context ID, and all that kind of settings. And here as proc, there's a tool called DPL KPI, so key performance indicators. And it's logging all kinds of information from proc about load of the system. What processes are running? How much CPU time and memory have these processes been using in the last second? So that's dumping a lot of performance-related information into the DLT log, which you can then again pick up and analyze with DLTLize to figure out what's happening on your device during test. And currently in DLTLize release, there are no plugins to analyze this particular bits of information because we internally have a different tool that does similar things. But that's one of the things that I also intend to write so that you can have a useful analysis of this default process logging as well to figure out. That's it.
I have a general question. So
yes.
Suppose I want to buy a car with a free software operating system, and which one would be the best in the market? A car system that can be hackable.
Unfortunately, I do not think that will be ever a thing. Yes. The problem is that in many jurisdictions, it's actually prohibited by law to sell cars to customers with modifiable software. It's required that the software on the car, that the whole components of the car, including the software, are actually pass certification by the government authorities. And parts of certification require that no uncertified software can be installed. So, yes, unfortunately, that's the way it's forced. The idea is so that the cars on the road do not cause trouble for other people on the same roads. So it's not about you being harmed by the car that you've hacked, but about other people being harmed by the car you've hacked for yourself. Yeah. We are basically out of time, unfortunately. So I'll be around to answer all your questions in the hallways. And so far, thank you.